cleaning to 2 or 3 days a week, leaving the majority of your days free for higher priority tasks. Regardless of your lifestyle, whether you're a bachelor entrepreneur or an office worker with a family, you undoubtedly have maintenance tasks that you can chunk together and tackle all at once. Your maintenance tasks, by their very nature, have to be kept up with. You can't always shrink, delegate, outsource, or eliminate them the way you can other low-return tasks. But you do have control over when you do them. By chunking them together and changing up when you work on your maintenance tasks, you create the space to focus on bigger things throughout the week. If scheduling a maintenance day is simply too unrealistic for you, try gathering a list of the maintenance tasks you do throughout the week and create a maintenance list. This will help you chunk together some of your maintenance tasks so you can get many of them out of the way when you're low on energy and can't focus on more impactful or meaningful tasks. Here's the curious thing about maintenance tasks. Although they require a good amount of time to complete, most of them use almost none of your focused energy or attention. In fact, you can do most of your maintenance tasks automatically without much thought. While multitasking will make you less productive as you try to focus on two things that require a lot of attention, it's possible to multitask and become more productive with maintenance tasks simply because they require almost none of your attention and your energy. When you do maintenance tasks, you have attention and energy to spare. Here are my favorite ways to use my time wisely when undertaking the tasks on my maintenance day list. Do them with someone else, like my girlfriend, to make the tasks more interesting and meaningful. Listen to a podcast or audiobook while completing them. I plow through so many tasks on my maintenance day, I can usually get through half of a book by the time I'm finished. Call someone or Skype someone so you can have a meaningful conversation while doing the tasks. Or do the tasks mindfully to work out my attention muscle. Or deliberately think about nothing while doing maintenance tasks to give my mind a chance to rest and wander. Want to accomplish more while completing your maintenance day tasks? The possibilities are endless. You can download a podcast to learn a new language, or plan for a vacation, do bodyweight exercises, or practice a new skill. Although it's not possible to eliminate all the pesky maintenance tasks from your life, it is possible to spend your time on them much more intelligently and fruitfully. By the way, try setting a time limit for how long you'll work on your maintenance tasks to get more done in less time. Just make sure you don't work on them during your BPT. That time is sacred. Striving for imperfection. In the years following my first maintenance day ritual, I've noticed a ton of benefits that extend beyond having more time for important and meaningful tasks throughout the week. Having a maintenance day helps you eliminate both physical and mental clutter, so you can approach each new week with more mental clarity and focus. Plus, it feels freaking amazing to accomplish 10 or 15 things at once and check them off your to-do list. Over time, one of the biggest hidden benefits I've realized is that it causes me to waste less time. By their very nature, maintenance tasks shouldn't be done to perfection. They're low return. They support your work, but they aren't as essential as the high return and meaningful tasks they support. Many people, myself included, are perfectionists. We have the tendency to continue to work on tasks beyond the point when they're good enough, where the return on investing more time into them diminishes rapidly. Picasso spent a lifetime mastering the art of painting. Every small improvement made his work that much richer. But low-return maintenance tasks don't offer the same return on investment. Past a certain point, overattending to more menial tasks simply cuts into the time you would have otherwise spent on more meaningful or higher-return activities. Lumping together your maintenance tasks, whether on a maintenance day or with a maintenance list, helps you eliminate spending too much time on them. And it gives you fewer lower-return tasks to waste time on throughout the week, which gives you the time to focus on what's actually important. There is a time and a place for perfection, but your maintenance tasks aren't it. The extra time you spend on them is simply wasted. You can always make your house 10% cleaner, but does anyone really care? Chunking your maintenance tasks together is the perfect antidote to being a perfectionist about the wrong things. The End of Time Management. In a book about productivity, it may seem strange that I've only dedicated 3 chapters to time management techniques. But, as I've discussed, time management simply isn't as important in the knowledge economy as it was in the time economy. In the knowledge economy, the most productive people see time as the backdrop against which they work. Some coordination is essential for managing your time around the work of other people and for working smarter instead of harder. But whenever possible, the most productive people let time management take the back seat to how they manage their energy and attention. It used to be that time was the only resource we had to manage. Today, your time, attention, and energy are more interconnected than they ever have been, and the most productive people manage all 3. Time management is impossible. It's possible to manage when you work on things. You can't manage or control time. It's been ticking on for 13.8 billion years, and it shows no sign of stopping. The Maintenance Challenge. Time required: 10 minutes throughout the week, a few hours for the ritual, depending on how many tasks you chunk together. Energy and focus required: 2 out of 10. Value: 7 out of 10. Fun: 8 out of 10. What you'll get out of it: you'll carve out more attention and energy to focus on important things throughout the week. You'll also procrastinate less, experience more mental clarity, and feel great when you tackle a dozen of your maintenance tasks at once. Establishing a maintenance day ritual is one of the most powerful things you can do to free up attention and energy throughout the week. Here's the challenge for this chapter. Next week, continue to do your maintenance tasks throughout the week, but as you do them, write them down on your maintenance day list if you think you can do them safely later on in the week. Watering plants, for example, or emptying the kitty litter may not wait. If you're like me, you'll be surprised by how many tasks you don't have to do throughout the week, but can group them together on a maintenance day or on a maintenance list. Then, the next week, schedule a maintenance day or half day to tackle the tasks all at once. To use that time even more productively, use the spare energy and attention you have during your tasks for something even more important and meaningful, like learning a new language or listening to a favorite NPR podcast. Just make sure you don't tackle maintenance tasks during your BPT. That time is sacred. If you're like me, once you start, you won't go back. Part 4: The Zen of Productivity. Chapter 12: The Zen of Productivity. Takeaway: support tasks like checking email are likely a necessary evil for your workday, but shrinking how much time, attention, and energy you spend on them is one key to increasing your productivity. By creating more time and space around your highest return activities, you become more creative, focused, and productive. Zen in May. If you ever find yourself in Ottawa in May with an hour or two to spare, head down to Dow's Lake, a man-made lake that sits smack dab in the middle of the city. While the lake itself is pretty, especially in the wintertime when it freezes over and becomes one of the longest skating rinks in the world, what's even more attractive are the tulips that surround the lake in May. Every May, some 300,000 tulips planted around the Rideau Canal, which Dow's Lake flows into, come into full bloom. Whether you're into flowers or not, it's a great place to unwind with friends, your significant other, or to take a bunch of appreciative tourists. The other day, while looking through the pictures I took during my project, I stopped on one that I took on Sunday, May 5th, just 4 days after I started my project. The picture looks up at a couple of leafy green trees, but it is focused on a book I'm holding up in the foreground, Wrapped by Winifred Gallagher, the first book I read for my project. The picture perfectly embodies my emotions at the beginning of my project, a zen-like calm and engaged curiosity while being incredibly focused on the subject of productivity. Before the explosion of interest in my project, months later, the simple prospect of experimenting with productivity in a calm, curious, and focused way for a year was more alluring to me than even a lucrative job offer or two. Opportunity knocks. But as my project progressed, its nature began to change very quickly. 8 short months after I started my project, 5 months after my productivity experiment to meditate for 35 hours, and just 2 months after TED organizers published their interview with me, my project suddenly started to get, well, a lot bigger. Seemingly overnight, it gained momentum, and my site went from receiving a few hundred hits a day to several thousand. My blog went from receiving a handful of comments every week to receiving dozens, and I went from receiving about 30 emails every day to receiving a few hundred emails a day, and I quickly began to field requests for more media interviews, meetings, and productivity coaching calls than I knew what to do with. The zen-like nature of my project quickly became disrupted, but in the best way possible. Since I designed my project from the ground up to experiment with productivity, it was a pretty sweet problem to have. Oddly enough, the tasks in my project that began to balloon were all tasks that supported my work. Answering email, attending meetings, and keeping up with social media are the maintenance tasks of work. They support the most fruitful tasks in your job, and just like doing the laundry and paying the bills, they're very hard to get rid of. For me, support tasks are almost as pesky as maintenance tasks, because like your maintenance tasks, they can eat up a ton of your valuable time, attention, and energy, which you would have otherwise spent on more valuable and meaningful things. But there is a more nuanced cost to spending too much time on low-return tasks. They're much easier to work on. They're the watching Netflixes of the work world. Your limbic system puts up less of a fight against checking your email one more time, arranging one more phone call, or attending one more meeting. It's pretty easy to convince yourself in the moment that your low-impact tasks are more important than your real work, even though they provide you with a much smaller return on your time in the long run. As with maintenance tasks, I've found that the answer to dealing with the low-return tasks in your work isn't to work faster or harder, or put in insanely long hours to get everything done. It's to shrink how much time, attention, and energy you spend on them in the first place. The Zen of Less. The reason simplifying the low-impact tasks in your work can be so powerful is simple. The less time and attention you spend on them, the more time and attention you can invest in what's important. Your goal should be to simplify your work, so you spend most of your time on your most productive tasks. Remember those 16-piece 4x4 sliding puzzles you played with as a kid, where one square was empty and you slid the other pieces around to unscramble the puzzle? That's what your time is like. The more open space you have in your schedule, the more flexibility you have for when you work on tasks. And since your focus and energy fluctuate so much over the day, the more productive you can become. Simplifying what you take on lets you become more responsive to tasks and projects that come your way that are your highest return tasks. At the same time, things happen. A crisis erupts at work. Your kid comes down with the flu, your boss calls an urgent meeting, or your girlfriend is nagging you to go for a run with her, which is actually happening to me as I write this sentence. Simplifying and creating more space around your high-return tasks gives you the wiggle room to react and then deal with whatever unexpected task comes along. In addition, simplifying what you take on provides you with a beautiful, zen-like mental clarity throughout the day, which feels absolutely incredible. According to urban planners, maybe even the same urban planners who came up with the idea of desire paths, what allows traffic to flow on the highway isn't how many cars there are or how fast the cars move. It's how much space exists between the cars. The same is true for the tasks you work on throughout the day. It's difficult to be productive when you try to cram as much into your day as possible because you'll inevitably create a mental logjam as unexpected tasks crop up. By simplifying how much you take on, you create more attentional space around your high-return activities so you can focus on them much more deeply. Tasks are the cars on the productivity superhighway. That might be one of the corniest things I've ever said, but I'm going to leave it in here to poke fun at myself later on. Creating more attentional space around your highest return activities will also help you come up with better ideas. The reason we tend to come up with a lot more great ideas in the shower compared to when we're on a smartphone is simple. When we're taking a shower, we create enough attentional space for our mind to wander and for new ideas and thoughts to bubble up to the surface. Simplifying your life of low-return tasks has a similar effect. Doing so not only allows you to dedicate more time and attention to your highest return tasks, it also helps you generate more great ideas for them. By creating more space between your high return tasks and commitments, you can immerse yourself in them more completely, work smarter, and give them the time and attention they deserve. The next two chapters contain the very best ways I discovered during my project to do that. Chapter 13, Shrinking the Unimportant. Takeaway. Every single support task in your work can be either shrunk, delegated, or even, in a few rare cases, eliminated entirely. After you have a better grip on how much time and attention you spend on your problem tasks, the maintenance tasks in your work are a lot easier to deal with. The unimportant. Despite taking the time to figure out my highest impact tasks at the beginning of my project, I didn't do anything about the lower return tasks in my work until it was almost too late, until I was so overwhelmed by my support tasks that my productivity plummeted. Something had to give. One surprise discovery I made after looking at my first time log, in addition to how much time I spent procrastinating, was how much time I spent working on low-return maintenance tasks throughout the week. Even though I felt productive because I was so busy working on them, they didn't lead me to accomplish anything meaningful. Parkinson's Law states that your work expands to fit the amount of time you have available for it. In my project, I found this law to be especially true with tasks that are low-return. Because your limbic system puts up such a fight against working on your more challenging, highest return tasks, the low impact tasks that support your work almost serve as work crack or work candy. You feel productive when you work on them. After all, you're incredibly busy, but they lead you to accomplish less. Looking through my list of work tasks in my time log, I pinpointed the problem tasks in my work that ate up the most time, the ones that expanded to fit how much time I had available. They were, in order of how much time and attention they consumed, answering email, attending meetings, loading blog articles and newsletters, managing my calendar, coaching people and businesses on productivity, researching and scheduling travel, coordinating and participating in conference calls, doing website maintenance, and managing my social media accounts. Chances are that you have similar maintenance-type tasks that support your real work. Pretty much every knowledge worker on the planet is inundated with email and gets invited to too many meetings and events. But as I discovered, there's good news. Every single support task can either be shrunk, delegated, or perhaps eliminated entirely. Your low-hanging fruit. Depending on how defensive or protective you are of your time, you may discover that you have a few low-impact tasks that you can eliminate entirely. In my experience, though, it's very difficult to eliminate all these tasks. In the jobs I've worked in the past, I was paid to work on a lot of tasks that weren't always the best use of my time. And though pushing back against many of them would have made me more productive, doing so would have also made me look like a jerk or would have gotten me fired. However, you may find that there are tasks and responsibilities that you can eliminate entirely. Tasks like recurring low-return meetings, low-return phone calls in the productivity porn of social media and news websites and other time wasters, tasks and projects that make little use of your time or unique talent or skills, and tasks and projects in which you contribute little value but which take up a lot of time. I found that the tasks that support your work will almost always outnumber the tasks that you can safely eliminate. But if you do have low-hanging fruit on your list of low-leverage tasks that you can pluck and eliminate, it's worth making an effort to do so, to free up valuable time and attention that you can better spend on your most important tasks. In my productivity project, I found I could only completely eliminate one item from my list, coaching people and businesses. Although the work paid decent money, it didn't directly contribute to my project or let me reach out to more people with my work. Alas, the rest I had to shrink the hard way. Severe shrinkage. I was in the pool, George Costanza. After being stuck in email and meeting hell for a solid month or two, I finally decided to experiment with how I could shrink my support tasks to carve out more time and attentional space to get more actual, real work done. After a lot of trial, error, and late nights, I found that the most effective answer to shrinking low-return support tasks was to, 1, become aware of how much time and attention I spent on support tasks, and 2, shrink the tasks by setting limits. The simple act of keeping a time log makes you more aware of what you're working on daily. But time is only one part of the story. Low-return tasks can also take up a boatload of your attention. Take email, for example. After becoming inundated with email during my project, I asked several friends in an informal survey to keep a tally of how often they checked for new email messages at work every day for a week. The average between them? An astounding 41 times. Another, more scientific study found that most people check email about every 15 minutes, which adds up to 32 times over an 8-hour day. When you check for new email 32 times a day, that's 32 times your attention is derailed from what you're supposed to be working on. It's pretty hard to maintain any mental clarity in those conditions. Email may be a vital support task, but you also don't have to check it 32 times a day. I didn't fare any better. Even while trying to work as deliberately as possible, I checked for new messages 36 times a day. After you identify your problem tasks, think about how frequently you focus on them throughout the day by keeping a formal tally for a day or two. After you have a grip on how much time and attention you spend on problem tasks, you'll find they're a lot easier to deal with. The best solution I've found to shrinking mine has been to set limits, both for how much time I spend on the task and for how often I focus on the task. Attention hogs. Some support tasks in your work take up a disproportionate amount of your attention rather than your time. For example, most emails take a minute or two to respond to, but when you check your email dozens of times a day, that's countless times you have to transition from focusing on something important to focusing on email. The switching costs associated with multitasking can be so enormous that I've devoted an entire later chapter to them. There's also, of course, the uncertainty that comes with not knowing whether you have new messages, which costs you even more attentional space, not to mention how often email alerts interrupt you when you're trying to work on something more productive. For tasks like email, the best way I've found to shrink their impact on time and productivity is to limit how often I focus on them throughout the day. I turn off my email alerts and only check emails at a few specific times, in the morning, before lunch, and at the end of the day. And I found similar limits can work wonders for tasks like checking social media, making phone calls, and sending and responding to instant messages. That said, some emails are worth spending more time on. Forcing yourself to wait before responding gives your mind time to collect and form a thoughtful reply. And you might save yourself from sending a bunch of emails back and forth in the end. The following are just a few examples of the limits I set during my project. I scheduled just 3 30-minute chunks of time every day to deal with email. Limited myself to checking social media 5 times a day. Lumped similar tasks together so I could focus on them less frequently, like by making all my phone calls at once. Limited myself to starting just 5 new IM conversations a day. And only checked for new email when I had the time, focus, and energy to respond to everything that might have come in. Determining ahead of time when you'll tackle a task like email, as opposed to whenever it comes in or when you get the urge to, does a number of things at once. It helps you carve out more attentional space. It helps you work more deliberately. And it helps you stop thinking about your support tasks throughout the day because you've decided ahead of time when you'll focus on them. It took me a few weeks to settle into a routine where I check messages less frequently. But as with connecting to the internet less during the workday, after I settled into a new routine where I focused on my low-impact tasks less often, I had more mental clarity to devote to my real work than I had in a long, long time. Time hogs. Many support tasks suck up more of your time than they do your attention. Take meetings as an example. Although some meetings are important, the average person wastes an incredible amount of time in them, 37% of the average office worker's time is spent in meetings. A survey of 150 senior executives found that they think 28% of meetings are an unnecessary waste of time. I'd argue that number is north of 50% for most workers because senior executives aren't invited to the most pointless ones. Unproductive meetings are the opposite of support tasks like email. They use up a ton of your time, but hardly any of your attention or energy. Here are a couple of examples of how I put time limits on meetings during my project. Granted, I am in more control of my day than most office workers and managers. 1. Limited myself to attending 4 hours of meetings a week and pushed back on or canceled any meetings beyond that. And 2, took vacations away from support tasks, like I took a holiday away from email for a day or two by setting up a temporary autoresponder so I could work on a project that was high impact. These limits not only motivated me to get tasks done faster, they also forced me to come up with clever ideas to work smarter because I only had so much time. For support tasks that take up a lot of time and attention, I think it's helpful to set a time and attention limit for the task. During the productivity project, I found that email was sucking up a ton of my time. So in addition to blocking off 3 periods throughout the day to focus on emptying my inbox, I also made a rule that every single email I sent would be 5 sentences or less. I simply made a note of my actions in my email signature, quote, "For your benefit and mine, I keep every email I send to 5 sentences or less," end quote, to be as transparent as possible. My email recipients seemed to understand, and I instantly felt able to blow through my email inbox like never before. When I found it hard to make a response shorter than 5 sentences, I discovered it was a cue that a phone call was usually a more productive way to handle the matter anyway. Some time hogs, like idle office chit-chat, are inherently harder to tame. Although forming deeper office friendships can help your productivity quite a bit, it's also worth reflecting on whether idle office chit-chat is costing you valuable time. If it is, making a plan to avoid the banter, like by wearing headphones when working on critical tasks, avoiding gossip like the plague, finding another place to take a break besides in your office, asking the person interrupting you to help out with your work, or closing your office door during your BPT will help you free up even more time for your highest impact tasks. Just as a maintenance day creates structure around the support tasks in your life, setting limits for support tasks in your work makes it much harder for them to expand and take up more of your time or attention than they need to. By the way, you can also shrink the distractions of email by installing a Send It Later email plugin. My favorites at the time of writing for Gmail: Boomerang at boomeranggmail.com, Write Inbox at writeinbox.com, Apple Mail, Send Later at chungwasoft.com/sendlater. For Outlook, Send Later at sendlateremail.com. For Android, Boomerang, boomeranggmail.com. Returning to Zen. Since my project found its legs, instead of checking my email countless times a day, as I did when I began to receive boatloads of email, I've slowly chipped away at how frequently I check for new messages. Today, I check my email 3 times every week. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoon at 3 p.m., the time of the day I switch from a maker's schedule into a manager's schedule when I have less energy, I fire up my email inbox and go through it. And I've stuck to that schedule now for a long time. I value my time and want to spend it on the tasks that let me accomplish the most. I have a second priority inbox that only about 10 people know about that I check a few times a day, so the people I care the most about and work the closest with can reach me more quickly. Like most people, I still receive a lot of email, but changing the way I've dealt with it has let me carve out more time and attention for what's actually important every day. Although you probably don't have the flexibility to check your email only 3 times a week, it's worth respecting your attention and checking your inbox less than you do today. If you want to accomplish more, having additional attentional space is crucial. When you respond to every email within a few minutes of receiving it, chances are you're not using your attention wisely. One illuminating study found that, quote, "In the majority of email sessions, users were simply checking their email without acting on it," end quote. Don't check your email unless you have enough time, focus, and energy to respond to whatever might come in. By the end of my year-long productivity project, I gradually became more ruthless about defending my time for meetings, though that change was a bit tougher to make. When a meeting didn't have a clear purpose or agenda, or I wasn't needed, I began to push back to reclaim the time I would have otherwise wasted. That isn't always easy, but whenever I've given a reason for not attending, people are typically understanding. When I absolutely have to attend a meeting, I'll often suggest shortening the meeting a little, which motivates everyone to expend more energy and focus over that shorter time to move through the meeting's agenda quicker. Because the default options in Outlook are to end a meeting on the 15, 30, 45, or 0 of the hour, people default to those limits. Why not end 10 minutes early? And if you can ask a meeting participant for a 1-minute recap after a meeting, it's probably not worth your time to attend. When you're nice about it and give a good reason, people are usually understanding. Although it's impossible to completely eliminate email in meetings, it's possible to control how intelligently you spend your time and attention on them. Shrinking your low-return support tasks is the best way I've found to do that. Well, one of the two best ways, but I'll get to that in a bit. The Zenning Out Challenge. Time required, 15 minutes. Energy and focus required, 7 out of 10, though it will vary depending on how strong your limbic system is. Value, 8 out of 10. Fun, 4.5 out of 10. What you'll get out of it. You'll spend considerably more time on your highest impact and most meaningful tasks every week instead of treading water while working on support tasks. The challenge for this chapter, once again, is simple. Choose one or two low-impact support tasks in your work that you have trouble taming and shrink them by setting a limit for how much time you spend on them, how frequently you focus on them, or both. But just a quick warning. When you shrink your low-impact maintenance tasks, something will happen that you may be familiar with by this point. Your limbic system will kick into full drive. When you simplify your work to focus on bigger and more challenging things throughout the week, your limbic system will act up. You'll feel guilty, wondering if you received any important email, as well as about pushing back on unimportant meetings or fighting the urge to check social media one more time. Resist the urge! Like disconnecting from the internet initially, that sense of misplaced guilt goes away with time, after which you'll be able to focus more easily on what's actually important. As an aside, don't be afraid to treat yourself after you successfully shrink your low-return tasks. When I chatted with Charles Duhigg, the author of the best-selling and acclaimed book, The Power of Habit, during my project, he stressed the importance of rewarding yourself as you form new habits. According to Charles, quote, when a habit and a reward become neurologically intertwined, what's actually happening is a neural pathway is developing that links those things together in our head, end quote. When you successfully shrink your low-return support tasks, don't be afraid to treat yourself with something you find genuinely rewarding to make the challenge more fun. It'll probably help you out in the long run. Chapter 14. Removing the Unimportant. Takeaway. The word no is a powerful tool in your productivity toolkit. While time is no longer money in the knowledge economy, money can buy you time when you spend it intelligently. For every low-impact task, project, and commitment you say no to, you say yes to working on your most valuable tasks. By eliminating and shrinking what I could, including coaching people and businesses, emailing, attending meetings, following social media, and accepting speaking gigs, I freed up a ton of time and attention to focus on bigger things. But as usual, I still wasn't satisfied. I still had a number of pesky, low-return tasks that needed to get done that I couldn't seem to shake off. Those included managing my calendar, arranging conference calls with multiple people, loading blog articles and newsletters, researching and scheduling travel, and doing website maintenance. These tasks all took a good amount of time and attention, and that was time taken away from what I figured were more vital or meaningful tasks. Thankfully, since we all deliver limited value through our low-impact tasks, We also don't bring anything unique to them. These tasks are prime candidates to be delegated to other people, and that's the third and final way to handle the lowest return tasks in your work. Delegating tasks admittedly isn't a realistic option for everyone, but it's a lot more accessible than you might think. What's your time worth? One of the most illuminating calculations you can make is how much your time is worth to you. Not just in general, but in precise dollars and cents. This is a calculation I've made periodically over the last few years whenever my life conditions have changed. The way I calculate it usually requires a bit of thought, but it's quite simple. Every so often I ask myself, how much would I be willing to pay in order to buy back 1 hour of my life? When I was a student and made almost no money, I was willing to pay very little. Since I had hardly any money to buy back my time with, I didn't have the financial freedom to hire people to do work for me. Back then, I figured my time was worth about $5 an hour. Because of this, I filed my own taxes and was willing to work for minimum wage because my time wasn't worth any more than that. At the beginning of the year of my productivity project, I was willing to buy back an hour of my life for about $10. Toward the end of my project, though, my time began to be worth significantly more, about $50 an hour. By then, I had established a small business that began to earn a sustainable income, and I began thinking about building up a team to whom I could delegate my lowest return tasks. Depending on how you value your time, it's possible to delegate tasks in your home as well. Tasks like mowing your lawn, shoveling snow, or cleaning your house are tasks that are relatively easy to delegate and will let you buy back hours of your life, or just teach your kids to do them. Like with most of the tactics in this book, buying back time isn't about doing less. It's about working smarter to do more of the things you find meaningful. I found that the value of my time has orbited around four things. One, how much money I earn. Two, how valuable my time is to me. Three, how valuable money is to me. And four, how overwhelmed I feel. I think if you're considering hiring an assistant, a virtual assistant, who's a part-time assistant who will work for you remotely, an intern, or a team, calculating the value of your time is essential. You may find that you don't value your time that much, and that you should work on your lowest impact tasks yourself. Or perhaps you'll see the value in getting someone else to do your low-return tasks for you. Regardless of where you stand, calculating the value of your time is worth the effort. My first assistant. As an experiment, toward the end of my project, I hired a virtual assistant. On the surface, the experiment was perfect. By delegating the low-impact tasks I had remaining, I would be able to hit several birds with one stone. At once, I'd be able to eliminate my remaining low-return tasks by delegating them to someone else and free up valuable time and attention to spend on more important things. Not everyone has the freedom to hire an assistant, but when I looked at the rates of virtual assistants, I began to get pretty excited. I would be able to delegate my low-impact tasks to whomever I chose, as well as any low-impact tasks that came in over the course of the week, and the average hourly rate for the assistants I considered hiring was about $5 to $10 an hour, way below the $50 an hour I valued my time at. Some folks charged way more, of course, but those people I ignored. But my first virtual assistant was absolutely terrible. Not to throw her too far under the bus, but before I hired her, I didn't do enough due diligence. Not only was she located in India, which made communicating across time zones difficult, she was unreliable, took forever to learn new tasks, and I'm pretty sure she relied heavily on Google Translate to speak English. Since most of the tasks I gave her were digital, the time zone issue didn't matter all that much. But because she didn't speak English well, and took so long to train even for the smallest tasks, I would have saved time and attention if I had simply done the work myself. My second assistant. Thankfully, a few months later, after working with a couple of other VAs on and off, Louise came along. When I gave a TEDx talk about my productivity project, Louise Jorgensen, a VA from Denmark, fortuitously stumbled upon my talk and decided to write a blog post about it. After I stumbled upon what she had written, it didn't take me long to ask if she had time to help me out. In a way, her blog post had carved out a desire path that led her directly to my project. As I quickly discovered, Louise was the opposite of my other inexpensive virtual assistants in pretty much every way. She was wicked smart, able to quickly learn pretty much anything, and had a ton of experience both with the kind of tasks that I sent her way and with productivity in general. She's still working for me today while she studies in Thailand. At first, I hired Louise simply to arrange calls and load up blog posts and email newsletters. But I soon also began to delegate other low-return tasks to her, like managing my calendar, booking appointments, researching and booking trips, and even doing website maintenance or hiring and managing other contractors to do that maintenance. I paid her $25 US an hour, substantially more than my first assistant, but she was easily worth it. It felt great to work on a project all day, hand it off to her in the evening, and have her work on it while I slept so I could be further ahead the next morning. Over the course of a month or so, as I began to trust Louise with more and more low-return tasks, I began to cross items off my to-do list and was able to free up more time and attention for bigger and better things. I had finally discovered the benefits I had hoped for with my first assistant. Here are the advantages of hiring a VA, in Louise's own words. Quote, it frees up time so you can focus on the activities that are at the core of your business and so that you can keep developing your business, she says. Quote, the more a business grows, the more tasks there are on the to-do list, so it is very helpful to delegate some of the time-consuming tasks to a VA. I found myself having more time to write, do research, read more books, and interview interesting people, my highest return and most meaningful tasks. I also began to have much more attentional space to think deeply about my highest return tasks and do a much better job of them. Is hiring a VA for everyone? And what do you look for? Again, Louise has some sage advice. Quote, first, you should know what kind of skills you're looking for. Do you mainly need someone to take care of your administrative tasks? Or do you need someone who can take care of your correspondence with, say, clients or colleagues? By knowing the tasks you need taken care of, you can look for someone who has matching skills. I also think it's more fruitful, easier, and enjoyable if you find someone that you can personally connect with. This is why I always talk with a potential client beforehand to see if our working styles match. That way, in the end, everyone is happier. Mistakes you shouldn't make. Even though I had to learn several lessons the hard way, I discovered a few important things that are worth keeping in mind if you decide to hire an assistant, a virtual assistant, an intern, or a team. Don't be afraid to pay a bit more for someone who's much more qualified. The less skilled someone is, the more time and attention you'll spend training and interfacing with the person on a daily basis, and that's a cost you should not overlook. For this reason, I recommend paying a bit more for someone more qualified if you can. For example, expect a good virtual assistant to run you between $15 and $30 an hour. Hiring someone in a different time zone can often be a good thing. Depending on the nature of your work and the type of tasks you intend to delegate, hiring someone in a different time zone can actually be advantageous for your work. For example, I have Louise load up a lot of blog articles and email newsletters, and because she's located overseas, I can finish a post in the evening, have her load it up overnight, and have it sent out for my review first thing in the morning. If you're hiring outside of your time zone, make sure whoever you're hiring is skilled and that the person is someone you can trust implicitly. Always check references. Good virtual assistants will usually have references from people who are happy with their work. Don't be afraid to check someone's references. It can save you a ton of time in the end. If you're not in the market for someone to support your work, consider outsourcing your work on a per-task basis when you have the flexibility or budget to do so. Here are a few great websites I've discovered over the last few years, and a couple that friends of mine have recommended, whether you're looking for someone to work with you on a constant basis or on a per-task basis. I don't have an affiliation with any of these, and have used them all. Fancyhands.com for hiring virtual assistants. Zirtual, Zirtual.com for hiring virtual assistants. EAHelp.com for hiring virtual assistants. Freelancer.com for per-task hiring. Upwork.com for per-task hiring. Job postings at local colleges and universities to hire an intern. Help wanted posts on Craigslist and Twitter for assistance. If you're in search of someone great to help you out, whether for specific tasks or on an ongoing basis, the preceding are some reputable websites that can give you the help you need. The most productive word in your vocabulary. The most productive word in your vocabulary is one of the first words you learned as a toddler. It is also the 56th most common word in the English language. No. When I realized I had bitten off more than I could chew as my project began to find its legs, I made a habit of deliberately saying no to low-return things every day. To me, it didn't matter whether they were large tasks or small things like listening to a podcast I wasn't interested in, responding to a mean email message, or reading the comment section on a news website. Making an effort to say no to things that weren't valuable, instead of accepting whatever came my way, saved me a great deal of time. While it's one thing to eliminate, shrink, and delegate the tasks and commitments you already have, the number of tasks and commitments you take on is not static. It fluctuates over time. If you don't continually defend your time and attention against low-return tasks, projects, and commitments, your life can easily become flooded with low-return activities. When Greg McKeown published his fantastic book Essentialism in 2014, a book about deliberately doing less, it struck a chord. When I asked Greg about what it was in his book that connected with so many people, he put it simply, "Everybody is in pain." He continued, quote, "People feel stretched too thin at work and at home. People feel busy but not productive. People feel constantly distracted and tripped by the trivial," end quote. Constantly trying to do more things instead of the right things leads to more stress, poorer quality of work, and lower productivity. The answer to this is to focus on the most essential tasks in your work and life. Perhaps my favorite rule that Greg talks about for eliminating and saying no to tasks, Greg calls these types of tasks non-essential, is his 90% rule. He argues that we shouldn't just eliminate and say no to tasks that are pointless. We should also eliminate many of the pretty good tasks in our life and work when we can, because they take valuable time away from our most essential tasks. The 90% rule is simple. When you look at a new opportunity, rank it on a scale of 1 to 100 on how valuable or meaningful you think it is. If it isn't a 90 or above, don't do it. As Greg put it, quote, "Your job isn't stuffing it all in, siphoning your energy into lots of good things. Your energy is best spent on the greatest things," end quote. Your energy is for working on what's important and most essential. For every low-impact task, project, and commitment you say no to, you can say yes to working on your most valuable tasks. This is, by the way, another great reason to work more deliberately instead of faster and harder. By working slower, you work with more awareness and mindfulness, and it's much easier to reflect on the return of the things that come your way. In a similar way, the commitments and obligations you keep should be where your most important tasks and projects stem from. Every commitment you make in your work and home life takes up some amount of time and attention. And each makes you less productive when it isn't high impact or meaningful to you. Take owning a home, for example. I'm lucky that at age 26, I can contemplate owning a home if I want to. But a few years ago, I made the decision not to. It's not that I don't eventually want to own a house. I absolutely love the idea of owning a home, having a yard to barbecue in, and having my own space. But like with waking up at 5:30 every morning, the idea simply isn't worth the amount of time it would take in practice at this point in my life. In an apartment or condo, I don't have to mow the lawn, take out the trash, shovel snow, or even repair my appliances when they break. Owning a home isn't a commitment I care enough about to sacrifice the time I can now spend on better things. Examining the commitments you take on and reflecting on their return will let you simplify your work and life and free up even more of your time and attentional space for commitments that are the most important to you. These commitments include things like the following: full and part-time jobs, industry associations you're a member of, owning and maintaining a home or a second home, educational commitments, for example, attending university or college or taking courses part-time, relationships and friendships, clubs you're involved with, and skills or hobbies you actively spend time on. I think a particularly powerful way to identify your commitments and obligations is to look at your low-impact tasks and then think about which commitments they belong to. Every task or project you have stems from a larger commitment. By actively thinking about what commitments every task or project is affiliated with, you can identify the highest and lowest return commitments in your life relatively easily. Not every low-return task or project is part of a low-return commitment, but many of them will be. I believe that one of the biggest reasons my productivity project began to find its legs was that I minimized how many other commitments I was involved with during that same time. When I started AYLP, I cut back on the number of commitments I took on and quit my part-time job and declined other job offers. I even permanently deleted my Facebook account to free up time and attention for my project, which produced more benefits and was more meaningful to me. While it may sound on the surface like my life was less rich because I eliminated these commitments, the opposite was the case. To me, my project was a much more meaningful and high-impact way to spend my time, and cutting down on the number of commitments I took on let me dive into it that much deeper. Yo-Yo Ma didn't become the greatest cellist in the world by juggling cello lessons with soccer practice, salsa classes, and a couple of part-time jobs. He became a great cellist by investing as much of his time and attention into practicing the cello as he could, and it shows. Similarly, one of the most productive and successful companies in the world is Apple. While other companies collect new product lineups like their Pokemon cards, Apple has a laser-like focus that has made it the most valuable company on the planet. The company has just four main product lines, the iPhone, iPad, Mac, and Apple Watch, and each line is just a few products deep and is updated only about once a year. At the time of writing, Apple is the world's largest company by market capitalization, yet every product the company makes would fit on a small table. Saying no is what got Apple there. When you look around, you can find countless examples of how simplifying your commitments can make you more focused and productive. By doing this, you're able to better spend your time, attention, and energy on the select commitments that yield the most, are the most meaningful to you, and create more time and attentional space for those valuable commitments. The most productive people take the time to not only understand what's important, but also to simplify everything else. The Delegation Challenge. Time required, 10 minutes. Energy and focus required, 8.5 out of 10. Value, 7 out of 10. Fun, 8.5 out of 10. Wow. What you'll get out of it? A deeper understanding of exactly how much your time is worth, which will tell you your tolerance for delegating and outsourcing tasks in your work and home life. My challenge for you in this chapter is to calculate the value of your time. Think deeply about how much you would pay to buy back an hour of your life, considering your income, how busy you are, and how valuable you find time and money to be, and then look at the cost of hiring someone to help you. A good assistant, a virtual assistant, an intern, or professional help in another area of your life. It could be the most productive calculation you'll ever make. And if you're looking to up your game even more, I challenge you to also, 1, consciously make an effort to say no to 5 things tomorrow, regardless of how large or small they are. And 2, think about the commitments and obligations involving your lowest return tasks and ask how much value they add to your life. Should you consider eliminating some? Of the 3 essential ingredients of productivity, your time is the most limited of them. It is worth spending as intelligently as possible. Part 5. Quiet your mind. Chapter 15. Emptying your brain. Takeaway. Externalizing your tasks and writing them down is a powerful way to free up mental space and get organized. Performing a brain dump, not only reduces stress and helps you focus, it also motivates you to action. Snowballing ideas. It's hard to imagine, for me at least, but there is a time when books, newspapers, and the like didn't exist, when there wasn't a way to capture and then spread your ideas to other people. With the advent of the printing press around 1440, books became civilization's first foray into externalizing knowledge and information on a large scale, which allowed humanity as a whole to become more productive. We no longer had to walk around carrying our collective knowledge in our heads. Instead, we could externalize it into a vast collection of books and then build upon those ideas to form newer and better ones. There were, of course, those who thought this was a terrible thing, at least at first. Long before the printing press was invented, Socrates was averse to writing, arguing that it would destroy our memories and weaken our minds, even going so far as to argue that it was, quote, inhuman, end quote. It's not uncommon to hear people saying the exact same thing today about Wikipedia and Google. But as powerful as our brains are, the latest neurological research shows that our brains are terrible at consciously processing more than a few thoughts at once. At best, our minds can only consciously hold onto a few ideas at a time, whether those include things we have to get done, emails we're remembering to send, or things we're waiting on. To summarize decades worth of complex neurological research in one sentence, our brains are built for solving problems, connecting dots, and forming new ideas, not for holding on to information that we can simply externalize. Here are a few examples. We can externalize tasks we have to do by putting them on a to-do list so they don't take up valuable space in our short-term memory or make us feel overwhelmed. We can put appointments and meetings in our calendar so we don't have to worry about them, and so we're reminded about them when the time is right. We can externalize things like our shopping list, so we don't forget half of what we need to buy the next time we're at the store, or realizing when we're hunkering down on something important that we forgot to buy cantaloupe. Just as the first books didn't weaken our minds, getting tasks, appointments, and information out of your head won't make your mind empty. It actually does the opposite by giving you more mental bandwidth. It frees up space so your brain can do what it's built for, forming new thoughts, ideas, and connections, and once you capture them all, snowballing them forward. Your mind is an insanely powerful thinking machine, but it's the wrong place to store everything you have to get done because it's simply not built for that purpose. The more you get out of your head, the more clearly you'll think. My first brain dump. The very first productivity book I bought about a decade ago was David Allen's Getting Things Done, GTD. The premise of the book lies on the same principle, that your mind is not the best place to store everything you have to get done. Allen pioneered a system for getting all of your tasks and projects out of your head into an external system, incredibly, before a wealth of research came out over the following decade that validated how powerful getting unresolved open loops outside of your head can be. As David Allen told me, your head is not for holding ideas, it's for having ideas. I can hardly remember what I had for breakfast this morning, let alone the productivity books I read back in high school, but luckily some memories stick with me to this day. My first brain dump was one of them. If you've ever created a to-do list, you're probably familiar with how great it feels to get everything you have to do out of your head. When I first cracked open Getting Things Done, this was one of the first activities David's canonical productivity book got me to do, but taken up several notches. I was in high school at the time, so I didn't have nearly as many responsibilities and commitments as I have now, but per the book's suggestion, I sat down with just a pen and a notepad and listed every single thing that I had to get done that was floating around in my head. I still remember being stunned by how much I had on my plate. During my first brain dump, I captured probably about 100 to-dos, projects I was in the middle of, things that slipped through the cracks that I'd forgotten about, and more. All that I was storing in my head that I hadn't given the time or space to rise to the surface. Anything that was weighing on my mind, even slightly, I detailed in my notepad. As David Allen explains, quote, "The first thing to do is to capture what's got your attention, then decide if it's actionable or not. And if it is, decide what the next action on it is and do the action right then if you can, end quote. The feeling I had after was, to put it very mildly, liberating. I felt as though a weight had been lifted from my shoulders. My mind was finally clear. As David writes in his book, quote, any would, could, should commitment held only in the psyche creates irrational and unresolvable pressure 24/7. What you need to do is take all of those things and one at a time, discipline yourself and ask yourself, is this something I'm actually going to do something about? He explains. Quote, if yes, then what's the very next thing you need to do to move that forward? That decision doesn't necessarily show up by itself. You have to think to decide what the next step is, whether it's to surf the web, make a phone call, draft a document on your computer. That granularity, getting it down to the next physical, visible action, is a really powerful thing to do. End quote. This is a result of what Bluma Zagartnik named the Zagartnik effect in the late 1920s. Incomplete or interrupted tasks weigh on our mind much more than completed tasks. After emptying my mind of everything that was weighing on it, I came to realize just how true this was as I experienced more space and clarity and felt less stress than I ever had before. My mind felt liberated, though it's worth noting that at this point, I hadn't yet discovered girls, whiskey, or cosmology. Incoming! But not only did David's book guide me to externalize the tasks in my head during that first mind dump, it also taught me how important it was to constantly capture tasks as they came up, especially if I wanted to maintain a clear mind. It's one thing to get every unresolved commitment you have out of your head and onto a task.